Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Anika Zubair, and welcome back to another episode of the Customer Success Channel podcast. This podcast is created for anyone working in or interested in the customer success field. On this podcast, we will be speaking to leaders in their industry about their experiences and definition of customer success and get their advice and best practices on how to run a CS organization. The world we live in today is changing day by day, and so is customer success. Due to the ongoing pandemic, businesses are continuing to adapt and change, and how we interact with our customers is also adapting and changing. For the last 4 months, tech companies have started to onboard new customers remotely. For some companies, this is something that has never been done before, and for others, it was natural to transition to remote onboarding. But now, after 4 months of remote onboarding, is your method still working? Are you still able to keep your customers engaged and deliver a successful onboarding completely remotely? These types of questions and many more are the types of questions we will be discussing with Chris Jones, who has been the Director of Customer Success for EMEA at Enborder for the last 3 years. And prior to Enborder, he was working in CS at LinkedIn. Today, we will speak to Chris so that he can share his wealth of knowledge on onboarding and how to keep your customers engaged during a remote onboarding session. The aim of today's podcast is to show you how to continue to onboard your clients remotely and continue to drive value remotely. Today, I would like to welcome Chris to the Customer Success Channel podcast to share his tips and tricks on how to continue to drive value from remote customer onboarding. Welcome, Chris, to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you on here today. Before we get started into the topic, could you please give our listeners a little bit of a background on yourself and how you started in customer success?
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here. Really love this topic. So for me, I, as the accent might sound, am an Australian, and I started out my career in Sydney and moved over to London in 2018. For me, customer success emerged back in 2014 during my time at LinkedIn, and the whole world of customer success was brand new to me. So I'd always had an interest in sales, and it appealed to me. But what I found is I often wanted to have more of that customer relationship angle. And so when I was there, a new team emerged in the small to medium business segment, and it was focused on this thing called customer success. And it really took my fancy.
Awesome. The customer success at LinkedIn seems like a big name to be starting in customer success. So there must have been a lot of things you learned and took away from that. But could you maybe please help us understand how your focus on customer success, both at LinkedIn and now in your current role, has led to your current leadership position?
For sure. And I think it was interesting at LinkedIn, you know, where it all kind of began. I was involved in creating the first small to medium business customer success function there, because they'd always had a big focus on the enterprise side of the business. But for the smaller customers, they'd often just put a lot of that support into online help and not really reactive. I guess it was mainly reactive focused, I should say, rather than proactive. And so when I was there, it was a great opportunity for me to see some great ways that worked, but also some areas that didn't work so well and we kind of failed at. And so after a couple of years of working there, I had a mentor of mine who actually used to work at LinkedIn who had joined a new startup called Enborder. And he reached out to me and was keen to get me to join the team. And it was interesting because I'd come from almost like a startup within LinkedIn building this new SMB team, but this new opportunity was more of a startup within a startup. So it was a very different set of skills that were needed. So when I joined Enborder back in 2017, I started helping build out the function back in Australia. And then the cooler bit, and I guess the great thing about working for startups, is within 6 months, I was actually asked to move over to London and start creating the team over here for EMEA. So it's been a really interesting last few years, to say the least.
Awesome. That's so cool. I like that whole startup within a startup. It sounded like Inception there, but also really awesome to see that you guys, you know, you had this amazing opportunity to really start from the ground up, and a lot of your previous experience helped that when you did move over here to London. So really cool to hear about that. So to set the tone for our listeners today, in your opinion, why is remote onboarding the future of CS, and how are you tackling onboarding at Enborder after, let's say, 4 months or so of remote work?
So the current situation obviously has forced us all to have to switch to this remote style of working. I mean, ideally, I really still feel strongly about that face-to-face personal interaction that hopefully we'll be able to return to some degree in the future. But I guess what we found in this current situation is there are significant ways that we can scale and we can create more time efficiencies in how we do our onboarding. I think there's a few different parts. One for me is that ability to cut down that dead time that we often see with traveling, whether it's waiting at an airport, whether it's at the train station, all of that time that we spend going between client meetings has now been cut down to nothing. So it allows for us to have a lot more time to spend in the actual meetings themselves. And then I think the other part is looking at the cost perspective. So we're now obviously not flying, we're not traveling around. So that cost to the business has really been reduced quite a lot as well. I think what I've also found is it actually, although everyone is really busy and there's lots of kind of fatigue with meetings, I have found it a bit easier to get meetings in the diary, especially with the more senior people and the customers. It's, I guess, allowing them not to have to literally run from meeting to meeting. It's now for them just logging off a Zoom and onto the next one. So I think it's actually making it a bit easier to get those diaries happening.
Amazing. That's so exciting. Sorry, just to interrupt there. Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people are trying to get executives into a meeting, and you're mentioning how like now it's easier than ever with this remote work situation that we find ourselves in. Is there something differently you guys are doing in order to get the executive into the meeting, or saying something different that gets them more excited to be at the meeting?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is around the agenda setting. And I think for us, it's the why. It's why is that executive sponsor required on this call? I think when they were, you know, face-to-face having to run between meetings, they mightn't have had enough oversight into why they were being invited to a certain meeting. So on the day, something might have popped up and they just didn't see as much value, you know, coming into the boardroom and having that meeting. They might have just said, apologies, I can't make it. Whereas now what we're finding is because a lot of it's done, it's the same way through calendar invites, but because it's probably more focused on that, having a really strong agenda of the why and the different roles that the individuals will play in that meeting seems to be really helping us get them on the call and being engaged on that call as well.
Yeah, amazing. Is that something that you're asking your CSMs to do during this extra dead time or travel time that you're mentioning that they're not having to do anymore? Is that a bigger part of getting the call set up, is making sure that agenda is rock solid to get the executive into that meeting?
Yeah, I think it's a collaboration between the sales partners and the CSMs. But I think especially for a new type of deal, it's really important that the salesperson who is involved in that process is really strong at aligning both the customer and the internal stakeholders to be on that call, and then working together to make sure that the agenda is rock solid. We've put things that we've learned from the sales process in that agenda, and we're actually making it very specific. So yes, I think sales, CS working together for sure.
Awesome. Amazing. Is there anything else that's maybe changed in the last few months of remote work that you want to highlight to our listeners when it comes to tackling onboarding?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I've found is you can't just recreate what you were doing before, because it just doesn't work. The things we were doing face-to-face don't work as well online. So for us, we can't do those all-day workshops that we used to do. It's really a matter of how do we get new tools and adapt our process to make sure that we're getting the same outcomes, but we're also being able to engage all the stakeholders throughout the whole process.
Awesome. Awesome. I think onboarding is so vital in the entire customer journey. And I think a lot of people in the CS world feel the same way. But from your perspective, why is continuing to evaluate your onboarding process vital at any SaaS company?
It's a really interesting one. And I think often I've been lucky in working at companies like LinkedIn and Enbordo, because often very forward thinking in the tools that we use and just the strategy that we deploy with our custom operations. But I think it's really important because as tools change, and what we found over the last 4 months in particular, they're changing very quickly. With those changes comes a change in customer expectation. And so if the customers are seeing all these new ways of working, if you're not evaluating your current processes and your current tools, then to the customer, it actually doesn't look that great. And they might see you as being a bit out of date, old fashioned, and you might actually struggle to keep that engagement up. So I just think in the current way that we're working, things are changing so quickly. So it's really important that we keep up to date with that.
Yeah, so important. You just brought up such a great point. I think even before everything that's happened in the last few months, everything was changing drastically as we are kind of in a technology era. But now more than ever, with everyone having to adapt to change week by week, month by month, depending on where you are in the world, it's so important to keep on top of all those kind of engagement levels and how you're really building out that process. Because like you said, if it's out of date, some people really won't be interested in continuing to have that conversation with you. So really valuable tip there. So from a high level breakdown, what did onboarding look like at Enborder before remote work started? Can you give us a little bit of a picture into that?
For sure. So to set the scene for Enborder, so we're an employee experience company and very much focused on employee transitions and engagement. So for us, we're quite fortunate to be able to have a lot of experience with a range of this knowledge from employee onboarding that we've been able to transfer onto the customer onboarding side of things. So before COVID or pre-COVID times, a big part of what we did was on the experience of our customers. And a lot of that was face-to-face design thinking workshops. So this was an interesting part for us because when you think about employee onboarding, a lot of it is process-driven, form completion, all that type of stuff. So for us as a company, we really want to try and get customers to think more about the experience and the engagement aspect. And so for us, we would go in with flip charts, sticky notes. We'd have a lot of energy, some really kind of creative ways to engage people face to face. We'd also do things like assisting with recording launch videos and maybe help with filming live videos of the employees and things like that. And so a lot of it was very face to face, even to the point of when they went live, we'd have gifts delivered to the team. So the team could share it within the office. So it was all very much about the experience of the customer, and it was all very face-to-face based.
Okay, cool. It sounds really engaged. It's really exciting. And obviously before all of this, all very possible to do in a pre-COVID world. But you kind of already highlighted this earlier when you were talking about kind of what's kind of changed for you guys. But when you look at that very high engaged, interactive, in-person kind of onboarding you guys had before, what's changed in your onboarding process now that you've had to do it remotely? And what kind of workflow are you following? Are you still doing those flip charts, but maybe only by a Zoom call? How are you kind of keeping that engagement going and making sure that the customer feels that they're getting the most from onboarding?
Yeah, so we've definitely changed. And I think that's probably the key message I would say. Anyone listening, you need to adapt your onboarding processes. So we've had to change. And, you know, we used to do these sessions that might be half a day or a full day. But running that 4-hour online workshop, it isn't fun for anyone. It's not fun for us who are running it. It's not fun for the people attending it. So we really had to think, okay, how do we tweak this? So what we've ended up doing is we've broken those sessions down into several different sessions over a bit of a longer period of time. So we now look to run our sessions from normally 90 minutes to 2 hours. That's really the threshold that we've seen kind of the attention span last for running these online sessions. And rather than doing them in one day, we might break them out over 2 days, over a week, and just to get all the people engaged that we need to. And what we've found is this allows for more, I guess, to come from the session because there's more engagement. But it also means that we have to be a bit more prepared as well. So we've had to do a lot of thinking around how do we give more pre-work for customers to complete, trying to give them some head start into the session rather than expecting them to do it all within the session. So we've used a lot of different bits of a resource that we had previously that we might share on the day. we're now showing that in advance as well. And then on the actual sessions, we always try and get our customers to have the camera on. And I've read a few articles about, you know, forcing people to have cameras versus not. But we find with these types of sessions, having that face-to-face engagement just really increases the participation as they're going through as well. And then from an actual tool perspective, so when we used to do our flip charts and our post-it notes, we've now used a tool called Mural, which is a really great way for us to have our online whiteboards. And you can actually get people involved in the session to either log in before and add some notes, or during the actual session, they can jump in and you can put post-it notes on the screen and you can add comments and all that fun stuff. And then we also use a tool called Aha Slides, which is a really great way that we found to kind of poll people on the call. So even if those people, maybe they don't want to unmute or they're just a bit shy in a group scenario, we want to give them the ability to be involved in the session where they can actually put answers or put questions through that online type of means as well. And then we've had to really change the way that we kind of share the findings from the sessions. So rather than having the physical flip chart paper, we're now making a more conscious effort to have boards in Trello or to use the Google Suite to share bits and pieces as we go through as well. So lots of changes within the actual sessions. And then, as I mentioned, a big part of it was focused on the experience that we gave customers. And we would always like to celebrate teams and we'd send cupcakes or something quite nice that the team could share. Now, obviously, everyone is remote. So we've changed tact a little bit there to actually use our own tool, which is kind of a workflow type tool. And we are launching our customers into the platform. We're getting them to fill in information about some of their hobbies or interests. And now what we're doing as a bit of a congratulations gift is we're sending e-vouchers and we're making that more tailored for the individual. And it's still focused on that personalization experience aspect. So yeah, from the whole, you know, planning of the workshops through to the running of the workshops through to when the customers go live, we've had to rethink the whole process that we go through.
Wow, that sounds like a massive change, but also really great things that you guys have made work for yourselves in a remote environment. I think when you first mentioned 90 minutes to 2 hours, I was like, gosh, that's so fatiguing. But there's so many other parts of that entire session that the customer has to engage, whether it be these digital slides and notes and things that you guys are doing, as well as obviously the big thank you at the end. It just seems like all still working towards a bigger goal and keeping people engaged is really the what you guys are trying to get to when it's the underlying, I guess, success factor here. And it's really awesome to hear how many different tools you guys are also using to adapt, because like you said before, in a room where you have everyone there and a whiteboard behind you, it's much easier. But all these tools that you just mentioned seemed super helpful. So really cool to see how you guys have adapted over time. At what point do you think a CSM should be introduced to a customer? What's like the first step in onboarding? Does that start in the sales cycle? Do you think that that should wait until, you know, the deal's closed? Where do you guys kind of start that engagement process?
It's a very interesting one. And I think at Enborder, we as the CS team, we wear many hats. So for us, it can be involved from the pre-sales process. So looking at some of those final stage conversations. I would probably say, though, where I think the CS team should be first involved is that kickoff call. So once the sale has gone through, I think it's really important that we have that CS interaction from that moment. And even for teams that do have a dedicated implementation team, I still think it's really important to have that CS involvement from that point, because I think if they're there from the beginning, they have the oversight about what was happening in the sales process, what the objectives are for the future. But also, I think it's nice for the customer to meet the team right at the beginning so that in the future, they don't feel like they're being thrown from department to department.
Yeah, so important to make sure that continuity is there when you are handing over a customer. And we could go on and on about that. That could be a totally different podcast. But I guess who takes responsibility for the onboarding plan and that kickoff call that you mentioned? Is that something that the CSM looks after, or does the salesperson have to set that up? How do you guys manage expectation externally, but also internally, who's taking that responsibility?
Yeah, so there's a few different roles. The account executive, so the at onboarder, the person who has closed the deal, we put the onus on them to make sure that we schedule the kickoff call. But then when we look at the actual onboarding plan and side of things, it's a bit of a combination. So at onboarder, we have, as I mentioned, the account executive who will sell the new business deals. Then we have the CSM. And then we also have another sales role called the relationship manager. And their role is focused on renewal and upsell. And the CSM is more focused on implementation and consulting. So in terms of that actual kickoff call and the onboarding plan, it's shared between the CSM and the relationship manager. But ultimately, the CSM is the person who's driving the goals and objectives as we go through. Within the call itself, we like to have a mix of people. So obviously, from our side, we have that account executive, the CSM, and the relationship manager involved. But we also will mandate that the executive sponsor, the decision maker, and the end users will be on that kickoff call as well, because then we feel like it holds that accountability. So in the future, all are on the same page in terms of what's expected and why we bought the product in. And it's also a great way to then align those goals and objectives and success measures, and then looking at what the implementation will look like, and then any key timelines that we need to work towards and goals we have to meet as we go through.
That's great. It seems like there's definitely a joint effort there, as well as joint responsibility, so that no, I guess, gaps are left in the customer journey, so that there's no, I guess, friction when it comes to what the customer is seeing and feeling when it comes to handing over from sales into CS. So that's really great to hear. You mentioned that there's quite a few people on that kickoff call, a lot of the executives. And I know we talked earlier that it seems to be easier to get execs on these calls now more than ever. But I can't believe we're almost after 5 months of remote work. I can't believe I'm saying that. But how are you continuing to make sure your customers, especially your executive sponsors and key users, take part of these calls, and how are you getting them to come to these calls in the first place, but not just in the first place, but even 6 months from now, how are you going to continue to make sure they stay engaged?
Yeah, I think it's the $1 million question, isn't it? In terms of how do we have that strong start? For us, it's all about that account executive, so that the salesperson who has been involved in the process, they're the one who's had the relationship with the customer. So we really make sure that they drive the ownership to get the right people on that call. You know, there might be times where for some reason something comes up and they can't make it, but generally we will make sure that they're on the call. I think the other part of it is thinking about the why, and I touched on this before, but it's really thinking of how do we frame this and how do we put the agenda together just to make it obvious that the executives are going to get value from the call, and we will actually be either having them talk a little bit, or we will be making sure that they're agreeing on certain elements that we're actually running through. So I think having that clear agenda is just a really great way to set that precedent for why it's important for them to be on not only the initial call, but also when they see the value they're getting from that call, and how kind of organized and structured the call is, when they see the quarterly reviews popping in the diary or the half-year reviews, they'll be more kind of on side with being on those calls because they'll be able to think about the value that they're going to get from those. And so what we often try and do is going with that structured approach on that kickoff call, blocking in some actual key dates over the next 12 months. So we might say, let's lock in a 6-month review. We'll pencil that in now, a 9-month review, et cetera, et cetera. So if we can not only have that clarity on the initial call to build that confidence, but also get some more structured points locked in the future, we find that really helps to try and build that returning of the execs in future calls.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think a lot of people are afraid to book something in that far in advance. But like you said, just penciling it in and saying, hey, we're going to have a call 6 months from now. I'm just going to put it in your calendar and then obviously chase it up close to the date just makes so much easier, because I don't know anyone, exec or not, that doesn't have a free slot 6 months from now. So it's usually so much easier to book that kind of time in. So yeah, totally agree. Something I do, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners will probably start doing as well now that they've heard it. But let's get into something a little bit deeper. I know we've talked about a lot of the theories and how you guys are kind of changing things and making things work, but do you guys actually track success plans and project onboardings? And how do you guys track these things? What kind of measurements are you looking at? And how do you guys really look at metrics when it comes to a successful onboarding?
That's the thing, isn't it? There's so much theory and there's so much thought you could put around this. We do though. So we actually use PlanHat. So within PlanHat, what we do is we use the playbook functionality. So for those who haven't seen PlanHat, it's basically a way that you can create different tasks and different actions that have to be completed at different journeys along the way. So we have a playbook for onboarding. And what it basically does is it lists out all the different steps that the CSMs have to take in order to have a successful onboarding. What we do as well is we put a 90-day implementation goal in place for us. So all of those different events are structured along a timeline, and they are giving you an idea of when milestones should be met along that 90-day journey. And so having this type of playbook, what each CSM can then do is they can see at a glance where all of their projects are at, where their customer implementation is. They can see which ones are going well and which ones are running over. And then from a leadership perspective, we can then see at a glance overall, how are we tracking from an engagement perspective? So we're really keen on that number of days that we want to get customers live in, mainly because we see churn rates increase for customers who don't go live within that 90-day period.
Yeah, I feel the same as well as a PlanHat user. It's so nice to have that timeline attached to everything, but also just making sure you're hitting those success milestones when you said you're going to hit them, because I think the whole topic of onboarding and what we've already discussed is making sure this onboarding is flawless and really up to scratch, because that really determines churn rate as well down the line. So really cool that you guys are tracking all those metrics. Really important. And I couldn't stress that enough. So thanks for sharing. I think jumping into the whole different side of things a little bit right now is, you mentioned that a lot of people are attending your meetings and you are seeing the same level of traction when it comes to getting people into a Zoom call. But I know for a lot of our listeners, and myself included, a lot of people are suffering from what's known as Zoom fatigue or canceling onboarding or just regular meetings because they are working remotely and they're too busy or they're, let's just say, too exhausted from too many Zoom meetings in one day. What kind of techniques are you guys using that's going to get them to re-engage and start to get in those calls again?
It's an interesting one I've found, because luckily at Enborder, we're focused on kind of employee transitions and employee engagement. And so for us, it's actually been a really interesting time, because a lot of companies are really wanting to speak to us because they're wanting to find ways to engage their employees during the whole remote work aspect. But there are, as you mentioned, a lot of companies out there, maybe the product isn't such a priority for them right now. And so they'll probably, you know, put off talking to you until it becomes a priority again. And, you know, there's a whole, almost like another podcast on that in terms of how do you make your product a priority. But I think some of the things that we've really looked at is thinking around, okay, if people don't have time for calls, do we have the right things in place for them to go to get a self-service type of experience? So a big thing for us was making sure that our help center and all of our articles are really up to date, but also adding more articles and more videos to make it more engaging for them as they go on there. So thinking around, okay, we can't get them on a training call, but as long as they go to our help center and we can direct them to the right places, then hopefully they'll be able to, you know, go through some training and some onboarding themselves if they have to. We've found that actually using Intercom, the tool we use for our help center, and also our in-product prompts, that's really helped, I think, because having that integrated into our product means that our customers can go in there and they can easily search for things. They can easily chat to us through the chat function if they don't have time or don't wish to jump on calls with us. So I think that's really helped for us, just making sure that we know that we have a really up-to-date help center. We've got some great articles. And then, you know, if they can't get on calls, we can at least direct them to somewhere we know is easy to use and lots of great content.
Yeah, that's so great. I think that a lot of people think that you have to interact with each customer on a phone call. And a lot of people, whether we're facing Zoom fatigue or not, some people just don't want to have a phone call. Maybe they just want to pick up a few things on their own time, or they just want to be directed to the right help doc, like you mentioned, as to, you know, what to do next. And it's so important to have those different mediums. And if you think about even learning styles, a lot of people are totally different at learning something new. Maybe they want to have a manual versus I'm definitely the type of person that's going to put it together without the manual and then look back at the manual, but definitely different people out there that want to learn in different ways. And so it's so important to provide those different avenues of learning for your customers, just in case they don't want to get on that onboarding call. So great to hear that you guys are doing that as well. What are some of the indicators that you guys look at when you need to revamp your onboarding process in order to continue to drive value to your customers? I think some of the listeners today are probably thinking, how am I going to continue to drive value to onboarding? And what indicators really are going to tell you that you need to revamp things?
Yeah, and it's one of those things I think we're all learning over the last 4 or 5 months. Similar to what we've mentioned earlier, one of the key things is if people aren't showing up to these trainings, a lot of it's probably due to the fact that you probably haven't tweaked your processes. And a lot of your processes might still be factoring in face-to-face workshops or sessions, or even just not thinking about the different ways and different stresses that the people have through working in this kind of remote setting. So I think one of the things that we're kind of looking at again is those implementation times and those key milestones being met, as we mentioned before, in that playbook functionality. So we really look at how we're tracking on those implementation plans. And then we're kind of seeing, okay, if these are now running longer than we wanted them to, or if we get a sense that we're not able to engage with them enough, we've got to think a bit differently about how we're going to go with this rollout. And I think a part of that is maybe if they've forgotten about us, it could be because they've lost the why and they've really forgotten about the product and the importance of it. So it could be a fact that, okay, if we can't get a hold of them, they're not turning up, implementation times are really long, should we go back and actually look at the business objectives and maybe just go over those again and make it really clear why it's important that we go live quickly? And I think a lot of that's based off the implementation times, I'd say.
Yeah, so important to reevaluate your why. I think a lot of people are always get their head stuck in the sand about we need to do this, this, and this in this order in order to see success. But a lot of times just taking a step back and questioning the why are we doing this? Why is the customer looking for this? Why is onboarding important to this industry or this sector? Or why is our product important to them? So important to just keep asking that why question when you are looking at revamping any process, really, not just onboarding. But yeah, thanks for mentioning that. So important. I guess moving on to my next question, what sort of onboarding engagement stats are you tracking? You did mention the onboarding playbook, but what are you tracking when it comes to onboarding? And then what are you doing with this data? Are these kind of KPIs your CSMs are held accountable to? Can you give us a little bit of detail into that?
For sure. The biggest one is that implementation goal of 90 days. That's our primary one that we do target. Along the way, though, on that 90 days, we look within our own product as well. So the way that our product's built, it's very self-service type product. Customer can log in and they can build their own experiences. So what we will do is we will look along that 90-day timeline if those key things are being checked. So have they actually created some different timelines? Have they used certain modules in those timelines? Have they put test people through the experience? have they put integrations in place? So a lot of it is product specific, and it's looking at key things that they have done that we know lead to a successful implementation. And what we're then doing is we're bringing a lot of those metrics back into PlanHack. So we're able to see from one source how engaged people are with the product, and then kind of overlay that with that implementation timeline.
Cool. It's amazing that you guys can keep it all in one place. It's so important. I think nowadays we track so many data points that it's so important to have one place where you can actually, as a CS leader, but also as a CSM, just see all that in one place, because it can get so overwhelming. And I know I felt like that before I implemented a CS tool as well. So cool to hear about that. My last question I have for you today before we move into our quick fire section is, you guys seem to have a pretty good grasp of keeping customers engaged, and you guys seem to be on the leading foot here when it comes to thinking of ways of engaging with your customers. But for some of our listeners, they might be thinking right now, how can I maybe engage more with my customers? How is your team looking for new ways to continue to make onboarding more engaging?
I think there's a few parts to this one. One part is the product itself, I'd say. So the actual product or service that your company is putting out there, that will obviously make a tremendous difference in and how engaging that onboarding experience can be. And I'm quite fortunate with Enborder to have a product that is very user-friendly and quite nice, which helps us, I think. But I think even if your product is a little bit tricky to use, maybe it requires a lot more initial setup and training, I think the learning resources that you have will make a big difference. And as we mentioned before, if you can try and have that self-service aspect to a certain extent, and have content that's easily digestible. So maybe it's a video if the text is a bit too wordy, or maybe it's linking from article to article quite easily to make it a nice experience for the end user. That's really, really important, just so that we can cater for those different learning styles, as you mentioned before. And then I think when we look at the bigger implementations that we go for, there's just constant learning that we can all be doing. And I'm often learning from our customers in terms of how they're project managing internal projects. And I think I will then bring some of that learning and bring it back into our own processes, which is kind of cool. Also looking at others in the industry, so podcasts like this one or other kind of CS forums, I think are really powerful to learn. But also blogs. I find a lot of on LinkedIn, we're looking at a lot of blogs, any cool little updates we're seeing from different companies, go lives, that type of thing. And all of us going out and having a look at what's happening with our networks, with our customers, we then all come back together and just discuss any new ways of working that we might have seen, and then think, how can we actually incorporate that back into our own process?
Yeah, awesome. I love how you mentioned the continuation of learning and how learning really never stops. I think, especially in the industry of customer success, we are pioneers. We are all trying to figure this out day by day, month by month, year by year. And what I really love is that there is so much content out there that you can consume when it comes to customer success and learning what others are doing, whether it's your customers, whether it's even a competitor. It's so much information that you could probably digest and be able to take back to your team in some capacity, whether it's a blog, a podcast, you know, LinkedIn post. There's just so much learning to be done out there, and utilizing your network in order to do that is so important, so valued. And I think that what you just said is really hitting home for me as well, personally, and I'm sure a lot of people listening feel the same way as well. But now that we've come towards the end of the conversation, I know that we could probably keep talking for ages on this, but I do want to wrap up with our quick fire questions, which are just three or four questions that I'd be asking you. Feel free to answer them as quickly as you can. Just a few sentences would be great. And the first question I have for you is, what do you think is next for the CS industry?
Big question. I think a lot more demand looking at CS as consultants, being armed with data and being able to tell stories with that data, I think is the next big step.
That's cool. I love data. So really cool that you mentioned that. Next question. What sort of tool set does your CS team currently use? I know you mentioned a lot earlier, but could you give us a little rehash of that?
Yep. So we use, for collaboration, Slack and Zoom. We use Intercom for our ticketing and our help centers. We use PlanHat for all of our monitoring and CS activities. And then we use a lot of the G Suite for collaboration. So that could be from all parts of G Suite. Very useful.
Cool. What sort of compensations should a CSM get? Should it be base salary only? Should it be base and commission? I know this is a $1 million question, but really curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the base plus commission, and looking at that commission component being a mix of implementation times and retention.
Cool. So data-driven commission. Like to hear that. And my final question for you today, Chris, what is your favorite part of customer success or being a CSM?
God, there's so much. I think for me, it's being that extended part of so many companies' teams. And with that, what you find is no 2 days ever the same.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think it's really exciting to be in a space where you never get bored, which is what I feel. But thank you so much, Chris, for your time. I really appreciate it. I know there's so many little things that I've already noted down that I know that I'm going to take back to my team. And I'm sure our listeners feel the same. But thank you so much for spending your time with us today on the Customer Success Channel podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Hopefully it was useful. And yeah, really appreciate it.
Cool. Thanks, Chris. See you later.